This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Steve Chiatakis with you. When Leah Garcia called police seeking safety from her abusive partner, she didn't expect Child Protective Services to get involved.
The social workers asked me, are you busy tomorrow? And I said, no, why? And they told me, oh, well, we would like to come over and just talk with you. And I said, okay. And I already had a feeling inside that they were going to take the kids away when they said that. But in my head, I was thinking, well, if they were going to take them away and I was so, like, you know, they thought so much that they shouldn't be here, why would they wait until tomorrow? Why would they wait a whole next day to come and take them from me? And sure enough, the next day when they came, they told me they were taking Joseph from me.
And what reason did they give you?
They gave me the reason that I wasn't protecting them properly. That I was, like, allowing the abuse in the home.
The social workers who took Garcia's children are from Los Angeles County's Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS. And what happened after Garcia's children were removed became a nightmare.
My head's just going out of control. Like, what happened to my son? Where's my son at? Like, why hasn't anybody called me? How come nobody contacted me? How come he was in the hospital?
Joseph is one of a small number of children who died in foster care here in LA. Now, the mission of the county agency is to protect children. And that can mean removing them from their family's care. But traumatic events can happen to kids at home and in foster care. How do social workers know which one is best for a child? Well, that's a judgment call, subject to human error and implicit racial bias. In fact, in a recent 12-month period, 24% of children removed from their homes in LA County were Black, though Black kids are only 7% of the county's population. Well, just this week, LA County announced plans to study whether social workers make different decisions when they don't know the race of the child. Reporter Deepa Fernandez has been reporting on the Garcia case and on bias in the child welfare system. Her two-part documentary for public radio program Latino USA aired last week and will air again this week. Deepa, welcome.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be here.
I want to ask you about what happened to Leah Garcia's son, but first, can you tell us a little more about this racial bias in the system that the LA County Board of Supervisors actually wants to research?
Well, you know, Steve, it's nothing new. It has existed for decades. But as you said, Black kids are way overrepresented in the system. Latino kids seem to be about the same as who's in the county, and white and Asian kids are much less likely to be removed from home. You know, and so that's led many people over years to ask questions about why this is and why it persists. You know, and I think one of the best answers that I got as I was researching this was from an attorney at public counsel. She's seen a lot of this over her years of working with women in the system. Her name is Sharon Bama Cartagena. And, you know, she thinks you have to actually go back to the point where people are calling in to report child abuse. You know, you call a hotline, you report what you suspect might be the abuse or neglect of a child. And this is where Cartagena thinks the implicit bias actually starts.
You have folks called on for behaviors that wouldn't be called on if, you know, they were honestly white and upper middle class. You know, I've seen cases where folks are called on for co-sleeping or for falling asleep while breastfeeding. I've seen cases where folks are called on for resource issues. There's a call by a teacher to the child abuse hotline because the child doesn't have glasses.
So these are cases where perhaps Child Protective Services shouldn't get involved in something, you know, the minutia of some things that happen on the day-to-day. And Deepa, in the documentary, you focus on two moms who had their kids removed because they were survivors of domestic violence. One was Leah Garcia. The other is a woman named Delasia Taylor. So they were the ones being battered. They did not harm their children, but they had the children taken from them. Do I have that right?
You do, Steve. And, you know, it's actually not uncommon for this to happen. The system calls it and I'm quoting, failure to protect. So it's looking at domestic violence as a form of violence that could get really dangerous, even deadly. And so social workers, when they come on the scene, they're trying to determine whether the non-offending parent is able to keep the child safe. And if they determine that they're not, it's called a failure to protect. Now, they're looking for very specific things here, Steve, in the actions of the non-offending parent. You know, so things like, have you gotten a restraining order? Are you going to get one? Are you going to move so that the batterer or the abuser doesn't know where you live? There's various things that a parent will have to do. And when you're in the middle of the situation, those things are not patently obvious. Do you have a family member who is willing to come in and help you? Are you protecting the abuser? And sometimes the mother will appear like she's protecting the abuser because she's so scared of Child Protective Services social workers taking her children that she feels like if she minimizes the abuse, then they may not take her children. Whereas in the eyes of social workers, once you start minimizing the abuse, you are less likely to protect your children. So it's a very complex and complicated situation.
And gobsmacking, by the way. I mean, minimizing abuse. I can't even, it's unfathomable. But I mean, what did you learn, Deepa, about how little ones are affected, that, you know, the children themselves, when they're taken from their mom or from their parents?
Yeah, Steve, this was definitely something I was looking into. And, you know, experts agree that it's really traumatic for all children to be taken from a parent, even if that parent is imperfect. But really traumatic, especially for small children. You know, and I really saw that in the things that Leah Garcia told me about her baby son, Joseph. What happened to him after he was removed?
He wasn't eating with her. She had mentioned that to me. He's not eating at all. And I told her, well, he was breastfed, so. And she's like, oh, it's just going to be a hard transition for him. And he wasn't sleeping. So he was having a hard time eating and sleeping when he was there.
Not eating and sleeping is roundly agreed by experts to be a sign of trauma in very little kids. You know, they don't have words, they're not talking, they can't say, I feel this. And in older kids, you're looking at behaviors like acting out or talking back or even withdrawing and not engaging with the foster family. There are a lot of signs that many foster children exhibit. And when I talked to Leah Garcia, Joseph was a classic example of that kind of trauma.
What happened to little Joseph, Joseph Chacon?
It's tragic what happened, Steve. So Garcia's children were taken from her because it was deemed she couldn't keep them safe from her abusive partner. But in foster care, her baby Joseph in his first foster home, he suffered a broken arm. So he's taken from that foster home after his broken arm, and he's moved to a new foster home. And he lived there for about 6 months before his mom got a call. And it's that call that none of us want to receive. And she learned from a detective that Joseph had died, and he was just 19 months old. Mm. And so what I spent my time trying to do, because she didn't get any answers, Steve, from authorities, from social workers. You know, I met her 6 months after Joseph had died, and she was still very much, you know, just didn't know. She had bare details. So I started to investigate it, and, you know, and I found quite a few discrepancies, and I think that's really what we go through step by step in the Latino USA documentaries.
It's so heartbreaking, Deepa, and amid the investigation into Joseph's death, that you discovered that another baby had actually died in the same foster home just 2 months before. I mean, how does that happen?
Yeah, that's kind of exactly what we wanted to know. You know, I literally was reading an autopsy report, and I had done a public records request to get 911 calls from the foster residents. And I just asked for any 911 calls from a year before Joseph died. I honestly didn't expect I'd get anything. And to hear that there was just 2 months before another foster baby who had died, who wasn't breathing in the home, and then to read it in the autopsy, you know, I think there are really big questions, and this is where we really begin to look at the system. But this second baby, his name is Draco Ford. He was just 3 months old. He was a premature baby, and he died according to the medical examiner, of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. But there are a lot of questions about his death too, because no children were removed from the home after he died. If DCFS had taken the other foster children out of that home while they investigated how Draco died, maybe Joseph Chacon would still be alive today.
The mother's name, as I mentioned, Deepa, is Delasia Taylor. Tell us what was going through her mind, how she was having to navigate all of this and all the questions that she had.
So, Steve, I really wanted to try and find Delasia Taylor, who is Draco Ford's mother, because, you know, I wanted to know more about him and the circumstances. And when I finally did find her, you know, I found a mother who's deeply in mourning, and she still feels the pain of when he was removed from her by social workers.
There's literally probably nothing more horrible than that feeling of your small and tiny baby being taken from you, and you don't know where they're going. They're just taking them somewhere and telling you, like, oh, you can't know where they are. Like,
her story very much reflects what Leah Garcia told me, Steve, in that she received very little information about how her son died. She had many questions that were not answered for her, and she still feels the pain of when he was removed from her by social workers when he was just a tiny baby.
Deepa, you don't name the foster mother or the social workers in your story on Latino USA when it seems there may have been some negligence or something going on there. Why not?
You know, Steve, we wanted to focus on the child welfare system as a whole and how it responds and reacts. Now, these are two really tragic deaths, and both mums, as we've talked about, received almost no information. And the more we dug, the more we realized that while individuals did play important roles in Joseph and Draco's deaths, the system as a whole hasn't been scrutinized. You know, and a big question is whether the system acted correctly. You know, why were there other children in the foster home not removed immediately when Draco died? You know, and in the documentary, we really do ask deep questions about the system. And we didn't want it to be a case where it could be put down to, you know, one bad apple foster mother or one bad apple social worker. We really wanted to look at the system as a whole.
And you end your reporting with a unique voice. This is a New York City mom who is actually calling for the entire child welfare system to be abolished. Explain that.
Well, you know, Steve, we often hear that term systemic racism, and this story really paints a picture of one of these systems, the child welfare system, and illuminates how that structural racism plays out. So, you know, as we talked about at the top of this, the number of Black children taken from their parents is so disproportionate, and it hasn't changed in decades, despite efforts to change the system. Now, the question is, would these two babies who died have been removed if they were white or Asian? And the data says probably not. They may not have even been on DCFS's radar. So that led us to this point of this growing movement, which really kind of is taking inspiration from Black Lives Matter to say, you know, do we need the child protective services system? Maybe it's time to abolish it on the grounds that it's a racist system. And in New York City, it's been a hotbed of this activism. And I talked to one of the mums who's been a leader in that. And she believes that the money that's spent on removing children and the whole foster care system, which is in the billions, Steve, could actually be spent to reinforce families before they might come to a place where social workers are removing their children.
What would it look like if we instead supported the family who we said was not rising to a level that we wish they would rise to in caring for their child? If they didn't lack a coat because instead of giving money to a foster parent, you bought a damn coat or you bought a bag of groceries.
So that's Joyce McMillan. And, you know, they have a pretty robust campaign in New York City that really is asking to abolish child protective services and build in a better social safety net early on.
Well, reporter Deepa Fernandez, my goodness, there is so much there. I want to thank you for your reporting and for coming on to Greater LA to talk about it. By the way, Deepa's documentary on the child welfare system can be found at latinousa.org. Just heartbreaking. Deepa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate you giving us the time.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
And now to another podcast, a podcast about the human condition.
Do you know the power that a hug can give someone? I'm rehabilitated, trying not to catch a case, so just listen. The silence of that embrace can feel louder than anyone saying, "I love you," all up in your face.
That is actress Kiki Palmer reading from the story Silent Love by Candace Price. Candace is involved in a program called Inside Out Writers. It's an LA-based nonprofit that teaches creative writing to young people who've been in and out of the criminal justice system and who are using that writing, their words, to help keep them out.
You know, I had, like, don't get me wrong, my life has not always been perfect. And I done had a couple of downfalls in my life. But at the same time, like, I'm at a happy place.
And these excerpts come from a new podcast called Written Off. Every episode features stories or poems written by currently and formerly incarcerated young people. The stories are read by celebrities such as Issa Rae, Randall Park, and John Legend. The guy behind it all is actor Jay Ellis. The show is a co-production of his production company, Black Bar Mitzvah, and Lemonada Media. Jay is here to tell us all about it. Hey, Jay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I want to congratulate you on the show and you know, tell us more about it. It's hosted by Walter Thompson Hernandez. Each episode is in two parts, a story and then an interview, right?
Yeah, you know, Walter is from Los Angeles. He's from South Central. He grew up, you know, himself being incarcerated a few times and then found his way to Harvard and then found his way writing for the New York Times. And then he wrote a book called Compton Cowboys, which is now being turned into a movie. And he recently hosted a podcast called California Love that was all about his formative years growing up in Los Angeles. And so he connected with these kids in a way that I don't know if any other host could have. And my producing partner, rather, Aaron Bergman, had been working with ILW for the last few years. On Saturdays, he volunteers and teaches classes inside the Central Juvenile Hall in Los Angeles County. And for years, we had wanted to find ways to, like, take the writing of these super talented, smart, creative, you know, writers and put their voices on a platform where the world could hear them and where maybe, you know, somebody wants to option their story and turn it into a book or a show or a movie or whatever it may be. And so we kind of, you know, noodled around on a few ideas, and I had worked with Lemonada before and on another project, and we went to them and pitched Written Off, and here we are.
I imagine, Jay, it's got to be tough to get people. It's difficult to get people to talk about their feelings, to talk about their lives, especially in the face of adversity, especially, you know, when you're talking about being incarcerated, facing those challenges. How do you do it? And how do they do it?
Yeah, you know, I'll say one of the things that we always talk about, you know, with the writers, and we're here to get whatever they want to write about and talk about. We usually write off of prompts. And in this case, for the podcast, we used From the Heart. And that kind of allowed them to really write about whatever they wanted. And I will say, you know, it's such a supportive group. And so many of them realize, you know, they hear their own talent. They see their own talent. And when they hear someone reading it or they stand up and read it for themselves, you really see this pride kind of you see their backs like straighten up a little bit, you know, they hold their heads a little higher, and they're happy to share their writing and what they've been through. And it's a really powerful, cathartic thing. And we're grateful, you know, for them giving us the opportunity and trusting us with their stories.
You've had experience teaching with Inside Out writers. What drew you to get involved in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, back to, you know, my producing partner, Aaron Bergman, he had been volunteering with ILW teaching inside a Central Juvenile Hall for years. And he called me one day and he was like, yo, man, I think the kids are going to know Blue from The Game, which was my first show, the first character I played and my first show. And he was like, oh, they all know The Game. They love that show. Like, they'll know who you are the minute you walk in the room. And so I was like, all right, I'll go. Like, you know, whatever. Like, of course I'll go. And, you know, I have had folks in my family who have been incarcerated or currently incarcerated, you know, so it's always been something that's kind of been on my heart and been in my life and an area where I've wanted to give myself and help in any way I could. And so when he asked me, it was a no-brainer. I went in and I watched him teach a class, and he taught a class to about 6 or 7 young men. But what he did that day and what ILW does, which is so great, is he used this prompt that they could easily relate to. And it was from Kendrick Lamar's Damn album. And it was a song called I. And they stood up one by one and they read their stories. And it was powerful. It was really, really strong. And amazing and just inspiring to see each of them read all these things that they knew, and they realized how smart they were. And that got me hooked. From then on, I was like, yo, I have to be a part of this any way I can.
At the beginning, yeah, I mean, that's the thing about getting people to open up, right, is you have to convince them that they're not only their story, but their lives are worthy, right? And telling your story sort of reclaims it, right, reclaims your worth. And that's what I think storytelling mm-hmm. is. And what when you hear these podcasts, when you hear these people talking about their lives, ups and downs, but mostly downs and getting back up, that's the worth of their life, right?
100%. I mean, you know, to hear these young folks have such strong points of view and convictions and also life experience and knowing that they can literally get back up from anything and start all over and keep going. And that is such a powerful, you know, it's will, right? It's the testament to human will and like what we can do when we just get back up and try again or get back up and face another day. And to hear them be able to tell their stories and watch them be able to see how important their stories are and how much their writing matters, not only to them, but to the world, and how many people want to hear them and are inspired by them. When they see that and when they hear that, it really is transformative.
How do you talk to people who just, you know, don't feel like that they're worth anything, that their lives are worth anything?
Yeah, you know, I'll say that one of the things that I think we often see, or IOW rather often sees with these young folks, is that they know they have potential and they know that they want to do something with their lives. They know that there is a system that looks at them in another way. And for us, it's about, all right, well, your voice is the only voice that matters right now in this moment. So say whatever it is that you want to say. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And, you know, I think it's the freedom of storytelling and the power of giving a voice agency, right? Like it's been talked about so much in the last few years, but like that is truly the power of watching folks take control of their own lives, is giving them the agency to use their own voices and to speak for themselves and to communicate and express themselves. And so we don't, you know, not to say that we don't see folks who are sometimes down, because we do, but it is, once they get writing, it is pretty easy to get them to see all the opportunity that they still have in life and all the amazing things they can go achieve, and how writing is something that, whether they want to be professional writers or whether they want to go be engineers or go to college, being able to write in the way that they do with no professional training, right, is such a powerful thing, because you need writing for pretty much, you need writing for everything. You need writing to fill out a job application or a personal essay for college or whatever it may be. And so this skill set that they're kind of honing and developing will serve them in life in so many ways. And they recognize that pretty quickly.
It's really a cool endeavor. I want to thank you for talking about it. And Jay Ellis, actor, writer, producer, and Written Off, by the way, is the podcast created and produced by Lemonada Media. It's out now wherever you listen to podcasts. Jay, thanks for taking time out to talk to us about it.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you guys for making some time.
That's all the time we have for today. Next week, the drought is once again top of mind. It's a problem all throughout the West, obviously. But how is it being viewed here in Southern California? Is it worse here? Is it better? Still a drought. Also next week, a trip to the South Bay for a look at the Free Republic of California, a new exhibit that envisions a sovereign nation, complete with Constitution, flag, Great Seal, one man's utopia in the middle of El Segundo. That and much more next week on GLA. And of course, join us for all our episodes by subscribing to the Greater LA Podcast, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Mike Newport, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl all help put this evening's show together. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.